You're listening to a podcast from DCT Audio. I'm Dave Thomas, and I've been producing audio content for over 10 years. Thank you for listening to this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. For several years now, the levels of mental health and well-being within the UK police have been in decline. Many will argue that this is a result of an ever-increasing workload, a reduction in capacity and experience, underfunding, and a perception that social and mainstream media proactively portray a negative narrative of law enforcement within the UK. Additionally, lenient sentencing, poor organisational practices, and the disproportionate time spent on officers under investigation have contributed to create a perfect storm. In this short series of podcasts, I will be looking at the rising trend of police officers taking their own lives. I will be speaking with a variety of people to put a spotlight on police suicide, the reasons behind it, and hopefully how we can halt its rise. I'm delighted to say that we've been joined by Andrea Quinton today. Just for a bit of context, Andrea, and just for the listener, can you just give me a little bit of a background summary of your career to date?
I joined GMP as a special constable, actually, back in 1989. I did that for 2 years, virtually worked full-time alongside my full-time job in those 2 years. And then I joined in 1991 because I loved the job. Nothing's changed in 34 years. I retired sort of around about 2 years ago in the role of a regional training team for firearms across the Northwest. So looking after all six Northwest forces. And in between all of that, I've spent a lot of time in all different roles in policing. So response, neighbourhood, a little bit in CID, plainclothes, training, and obviously lastly as a tactical firearms commander. So sort of like worked across the spectrum of policing, really.
And I think you retired as superintendent. I only mention that because we're going to talk about leadership a little bit later on. Yeah. The reason we're doing this podcast is that you wrote a blog about suicide in the police, and you called it, or should it be called, a critical incident. Now, for our non-police listeners, from a policing point of view, what is a critical incident?
Without going through the definition, a critical incident is anything, any incident where the police response to that incident has significant impact on the confidence of the public, the victim, the community in general. In this case, I think in terms of the internal community of policing, and damages that confidence, or could potentially damage that confidence. And that's why I was just literally considering this. I was watching the programme. I was seeing all of the information on LinkedIn and on social media about this problem. And I thought, actually, this is a critical incident. If one person dies every 10 days in any business in the UK, that would be deemed to be a critical incident. And the fact that we're not preventing that, or we're not doing what we need to do in order to prevent that from happening and from increasing, is something that I think is really serious. And therefore, it should be deemed as a critical incident so that we can put the right response in place.
And I suppose you've kind of answered the question I was just about to ask you, really. Is that what prompted you to write the article now?
I have a bit of a habit of this. I have a habit of listening to something in the news and then it has just an emotional impact on me. So I wrote a letter sort of 10 years ago, which was an open letter to the public, which led to me being involved in the Thin Blue Line UK. And that was after Dave was killed in Merseyside with somebody who was driving a stolen car when he was putting a stinger out. And it just really prompted me and made me feel. It just made me feel. And I think feeling is the thing. So this was the same thing. We'd been listening to this sort of like narrative, I guess, for months, haven't we, about suicide in the police service, how we look after people who are under investigation, well-being and welfare of police officers. It's sort of been a narrative over a number of months, even years now, in relation to social media. But that, those facts and those stark facts from that TV programme on Channel 4 just really made me think, actually, we've all got to do something about this. I'm no longer in the police. I'm not part of the police, but I still work with a lot of police officers. And actually, if we don't do something, who will?
You're obviously very passionate. And I'm just curious as to, has your own experience within the police shaped your views on well-being?
Yeah, I suppose it has. And I think I'm really lucky, Dave. I think I'm really lucky in that I came out of 34 years of policing relatively unscathed.
One piece.
In one piece. with all my mental health intact. And I remember having that conversation actually with a sergeant who said the only thing he wanted to do was to get to the end of his 30 years career in one piece. And actually he ended up being off for the last 6 months really poorly.
Well, what do we say to our mates that retired? What do we say? You made it.
You made it. You got out the other side. So I do think I'm lucky, but I've known a lot of people along the way who haven't been lucky. I've known officers who've died by suicide from my teams. I'm friends with a lot of people now who are going through a really tough time and who have been on the brink of suicide in very recent times. And I see the way they're treated, the way they're dealt with. And actually, I think most of the time, it isn't actually the thing that's making people take their lives. It's actually how they're treated by the police service, by the police officers, that is making them take that final step. And I think that's really sad. And I think if we can do anything about that, then we should.
So you mentioned workload, lack of resources and political indifference. Which of these do you see as the most important?
So I think it has to start with politics. Unfortunately, we are led by politics in the police service, and none of us want to be. None of us think there should ever be political interference. It's why there's so much backlash against police and crime commissioners, mayors, and they've all got obviously links to political parties, haven't they? But political indifference for me is huge. I think it's everything in relation to policing, not just in this area, but actually everything else around policing. And we saw it with Theresa May, didn't we? The fact that, you know, she talked about us crying wolf when actually the majority of us were saying what has now been proven to be the case.
I think a lot of people's blood is still boiling.
Absolutely. You know, that political indifference, I think, is critical, because if we don't get that bit right, we're never going to get the right support, either in terms of resources, in terms of the media, in terms of people really wanting to look after us, and in terms of money, ultimately. And, you know, Andy Rhodes was saying the other day, wasn't he, that actually there's a lot of things we can recommend, but it doesn't mean that every force can do it, because they haven't got the resources to do it. So if we don't get the political bit right, then we can't get anything else right. And we are, I feel like, the least resourced public sector service out there, because they can easily under-resource us because nobody else cares.
Like you, I remember that speech by Theresa May, and I'm still trying to fathom out how such a critical part of society within the UK can be underfunded and cut back to the extent that it is. And it can only be political.
The money comes from the government. You know, the money that funds police service comes from the government. It doesn't come from anywhere else. It's not coming from industry. It's not coming from, you know, private sales or anything like that. It comes from the government. So if they don't fund us properly, there is always going to be a lack of resources, whether that is money, people. I mean, when they did those cuts after Theresa May, we cut police stations, we cut lockers, we cut uniforms, we cut cars. It wasn't just the people. So when they then decide 10 years later that they're going to resource us again and upload the number of police officers in the country, none of the other stuff was there. We'd got rid of HR teams. We'd got rid of training ability. Training establishments didn't even exist. So you've actually got rid of a whole host of the layer underneath that you need to make that top bit work, which is part of the reason why we're losing so many people in the first 3 years service.
Mm. Well, going back to the political side, and I'm sure you, as many of us, have seen that video clip the other day, the two female officers allegedly coming to seize a mobile phone because of some hurty words that were said, when in fact the actual circumstances of that visit were completely different. It had been heavily edited, the context was taken out completely. So what do you think the impact of social media, and the media in general, I suppose, has on officer morale?
I think it really affects them. And actually, when I talk to clients now who I coach to join the police or to go for a promotion, it's one of the things they always mention as one of the challenges that they think they're going to face. That actually they're going to be continually reminded that they do a really bad job, because that's what social media does, and general media, actually. I actually think the BBC, ITV, I think they're all incredibly biased. None of them will ever criticise, if you've noticed, the NHS. But every one of them will criticise the police. Some of that comes from COVID, but I think some of it just comes from our love of the NHS generally as a nation. But that element of actually judged by social media, judged by that minute video, judged by something that someone else has said and then is shared a million times before anybody reads it. The headlines that are just put there in order to provoke people to comment, to look at it. And actually, the headlines are just not true. You know, so you read a headline and then you read behind it and you're like, well, that doesn't relate at all. There's no correlation between what the headline says and what's inside it. And it's exactly the same. I now literally do not believe anything I watch or read on social media unless I've actually gone to the source of it and found it at the beginning.
Often in situations, there's a vacuum of information, and that is a really dangerous thing to have because it's very easily filled. And whatever we think about what's going on in the United States at the moment, their police forces over there, they're really hot on media engagement. You know, you'll have an active shooter and within minutes they're on TV, Stay Inside or whatever, but they're given an update. It's not operationally sensitive, but they're just given a broad brushstroke of what's going on. I think the UK police are awful at engaging with the media.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think some of that comes from legislation. Some of it comes from, the information from judges and what's allowed in terms of disclosure. And I think we've naturally spent an entirety of our time thinking we can't give out private information or confidential information that's going to be used in a court case further down the line. And I think we're now hung up on that completely and we've got to change it. So whether it needs legislation change through judge and jury, or whether it's just something that actually we need to accept has to change as a policy, there's got to be a change to that instantaneous response to things that happen, because we've lost the narrative by the time we get to it. Generally, you know, you see something happening, we don't respond. It's viral, internationally viral within 24 hours. And it doesn't matter what we put out afterwards. No one's going to read the truth. I'm friends with BritCop, who a lot of people on here will know from social media, from LinkedIn, from X, from Instagram. I've met him. And actually, the Met trialled BritCop doing some 24-hour work on social media responses. And it really, really worked. It was really beneficial because there was a lot of times when a video would go out, it would go out with the wrong narrative. He can correct it straight away because he's seeing it. And the right message goes out from the Met. And actually, everyone goes, "Whew," and it just kills it dead. It kills that sharing, that negativity. It just stops it straight away. So the quicker we can do that, the better. So we have to have, I think, in line with what BritCop would say, actually, 24-hour social media response.
Yeah, and I think about those two female officers that are in that video, and I'm just wondering what care and support has been given to those two cops. Because they must be going through hell, to be honest with
you. Yeah, and there's a lot of examples of it, isn't there? There's a lot of examples out there. And absolutely, their faces are all over social media. They've got families. They potentially have children going to school. They might have parents who are working and are getting slated anyway via social media and in person. And I think that's the point. People don't realise that what they're putting on social media has a direct impact on the individuals involved. And you know, they've been completely criticised, and it doesn't matter that we've now exonerated them. It doesn't make any difference. That story is still spreading with a negative story.
It doesn't fit in with my truth.
It doesn't fit in with what I now know.
You know, it's a pretty bleak picture, isn't it, about social media? And what I'm on social media myself, and I have seen mainstream media and social media were clearly two opposites. But I've seen over the years, they are slowly starting to melt into one another, which I think is worrying. Social media can lead to internal investigations of police officers, rightly or wrongly. And that must place a huge mental strain on those officers under investigation.
Absolutely. Because, as we've already said, it's now internationally viral. Everybody's seen the pictures of them. Everybody's seen what they have been told about that story. So they've now got to defend themselves almost, not just with the police, but defend themselves with their own family, their own friends, their own peers. So they've got all of that defence going on. And they've got a video that's been circulated that might or might not be edited. And they've got to answer to that. So it's really difficult because, you know, and I think I put a post on LinkedIn the other week with a picture of a gun and said, you know, literally 0.1 seconds, 0.2 seconds, you're dead, the person's dead, or the police officer shot someone. Was it a real gun? It's too late. And the reality is that the decisions that police officers make and the things that they do happen like that, instantaneously. And therefore, the public then have however long they want to pore over that 1 second, break it down frame by frame. And that's what we're seeing on social media and the mainstream media. They're breaking those things down frame by frame, half the time putting them back together how they want them to look, and then putting it out. And everyone's already made a decision and a judgment. Nobody knows the background. That's what's happened with the two girls with the mobile phone story. It's what's happened at Manchester Airport. It happens across the country. And I don't know how we stop it. And I don't know how we stop that mainstream media seeping into social media, because they almost have to, because otherwise their stories have gone.
Do you know what I think? And it's a bit of a controversial view. The image of an organisation, I don't call the police an organisation, I call them an institution. How they look is everything. And you'll never beat the institution. And they have to protect their reputation at all costs, at all costs. And I don't think they're going about it the right way, because, as I say, they're creating this vacuum of not getting out there and putting the facts straight. And it's almost this, they don't want to upset anybody. But in the long run, they're creating a rod for their own back, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. Reputational risk is everything, isn't it? So the police service, whatever we want to call it, institution, they absolutely want to protect themselves. We police by consent in this country. And, you know, we're the only country in the world that polices in that way. That means we have to have the public on side. We know that public trust and confidence is dropping. And so naturally, the police go out to defend themselves instantaneously before they've spoken to the officers, mostly. Before they've spoken to the officers, before they've found out the facts themselves. And that's why we get these comments thrown out there. We're fully investigating. We've referred ourselves to IOPC. And, you know, as a senior leader, I understand why that is done. And I understand that it's done to say to the public, it's almost a holding statement, isn't it? A holding statement to the public. Hang on, we're looking into it. But as you say, it's far too slow. Because it doesn't matter whether we look into it and 3 days later tell the truth. It doesn't matter, because the public have already decided. The story's already out there. It's viral. No one's going to change it.
Mm. And that nicely brings me on to the trauma of an internal investigation. Regardless, let's just take out whether somebody is guilty or not guilty. Take that out of the equation. And almost from a well-being point of view, it's irrelevant. I was saying to Andy Rhodes in the last podcast, you know, I worked on child protection. And it was the only department where not only did I safeguard the victim, I also safeguarded the suspect, because not everybody's guilty. And some of these are pretty horrendous allegations. Why aren't we safeguarding police officers under investigation?
Do you know, I think if you asked police forces, if you asked PSB heads, I think they would all say they are. But the reality is we're not. And it's for a whole host of reasons. So the first thing is we isolate them straight off. So we tell our colleagues that they can't speak to them. They can't have anything to do with them. And if they do, that they're breaching policy and procedure. So that's the first thing. We've immediately isolated them. Secondly, who's looking after them? So we give them a welfare officer. Normally, we would give somebody a welfare officer, particularly if they're being suspended. But who is the welfare officer? So it's either a Fed rep who are working really hard to look after a whole host of people, and they're really struggling to keep up and keep up to date with everybody. I know Fed reps who've now broken, actually, but Fed reps who worked ridiculous hours, 90, 100, 110 hours a week. Just trying to keep on top of the Fed work, let alone their real job. Or we give them a welfare officer that is a sergeant or an inspector, somebody who is on the team, but is also managing 150 jobs, a lot of threat, harm and risk, and 20 other cops, if they're lucky, and they've got 20 cops on their team.
They may even be part of that allegation on the periphery.
Absolutely. They may be part of it. They may be a witness to it. And, you know, they just, with the best will in the world, they actually don't have time to really look after that officer. So we've isolated them, and then we've given them someone that can't look after them. And then we've got the slow processes, and it is really slow. I've spoken to people who've been in that position, and they'll say, I was told straight away that actually I had nothing to worry about, but I was still given the form. And 10, 11, 12 months later, I'm still waiting for that result to come through. And in the meantime, I've either been suspended or I've been moved into a different place. Nobody's allowed to speak to me. My welfare officer's too busy and no one's telling me anything. And I don't get told anything. Why are we in that position? We need to speed up that investigation. It needs to be completed at that point. So we've almost got this triple hat of that isolation, lack of anybody looking after them properly, and then the speed of the investigation, which is bound to create upset, mayhem. People feel they're just on their own. They don't know what's going to happen. the fear, am I going to lose my job? Am I going to be able to afford to keep this house? What are my children going to think when it hits the press? You know, and some of these cases do hit the media before we've even decided whether somebody's guilty or not. So there's a whole host of reasons why it's a problem.
We don't practice what we preach, do we? You know, when I was a detective, it was like, always keep the victim updated. Progress the investigation as fast as you can. None of those two things seem to happen in police investigate internal investigations. Why does it take so long, do you think?
Again, is it workload? Honestly, it's the one place I've never worked and I've always said I need to go and work because I've never criticised a department and not gone to work in it. So that's something that I've always thought going through life. I think there's a whole combination. I think there's workload in the department itself that just naturally slows everything down. I think there's the link with IOPC. I think there's a lack of investigation, a lack of urgency that just people just don't have. And then I don't know. Then it just seems to get stuck in the system. So somebody might have recommended that no action's taken, but it doesn't get to the next stage where the decision maker is. So that decision's not made. And then it keeps going on a bit further. And then someone comes in with something else. And I think, you know, I know that if I went out there to anybody who was under investigation, they would say they then went after me for everything else. So, you know, did I look on the computer for something that I shouldn't have looked on? Did I make a phone call I shouldn't have made? Whether that's true or not, Dave, it's irrelevant. That's a perception that's out there for those officers.
I've got a few friends that are either in the military or ex-military, and they have a completely different mind step. And we'll call them a mistake. Okay, there are certain mistakes that you can't walk back from. You make a mistake on the battlefield and people lose their lives. That clearly, that needs to be dealt with. But in the police, mistakes are seen as a bad thing. And therefore, we can't make mistakes. And which is why I think things are slow to change in the police, because everybody's scared to try something in case it doesn't work.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a learning organisation, don't we? Allegedly. It's another one of these tick box things. We've tick boxed. We've got a learning organisation. That's what we say. It's in our priorities. It's in our policy. It's what we tell all our staff when they join. But actually, we're not allowed to make mistakes. And if we do, we're criticised. We're not just challenged, and we don't just learn from that.
We're sanctioned.
We're sanctioned for some reason. Now, that doesn't always happen. It depends on the leaders. It depends on the direct line managers, but it does happen. So we state that we're a learning organisation. So do the IOPC for interest. They also state they're a learning organisation, but people are not allowed to make mistakes. And do you know what? It's the very first thing. I was in charge of the probationer training unit for a couple of years, and I used to always give them three pieces of advice when I started. And one of those pieces of advice was, if you make a mistake, admit it straight away. Straight away, come and tell me, because I can fix any mistake you make. I can manage it. I can minimise the impact of it. I can support you through it, even if it's something that does actually become criminal for whatever reason. But if you lie about it, then I can't. So at the point you lie, we've lost anything. So that used to be my first piece of advice. So I've always worked on the principle that we all make mistakes. I've made hundreds. We all make mistakes. We learn from them and we move on and we don't make the same mistake again. But actually, organisationally, although we say that's the case and although we say we're a learning organisation, we're also accountable to the public, and that always wins. I think that accountability to the public always wins over looking after the staff inside.
Yeah, I remember when I first joined at Blackpool, and Mick Barton was there as a DI, obviously went on to be the chief constable of Durham, I think it was. Had a particular set of views. Everybody that's worked for him loved him. And I remember him saying that if you do something wrong, and caveat this within reason, if you do something wrong, but you've done it for the right reason, he would always back you. And that's what you need to hear. You need that kind of safety net, don't you? That, I've got the freedom to try something. Yes. And if it's wrong, it's wrong. Yeah. But I did it for the right intention.
Absolutely. And I was talking to a girl today. I was on a coaching call today, and she was telling me about a siege that she dealt with where actually she made the decision to go into the house. And we don't tend to do that anymore. Yeah. We tend to wait, don't we? Negotiate, take the time. But her reason for why she went into the house was perfectly valid. And after investigation of both her and the taser officer who were involved, they were both completely exonerated quite quickly. It never became anything in the public arena, so it wasn't something that hit the press. But, you know, that's perfect. She's tried. She did the right thing. Everyone stayed safe. So there was a really good result at the end of it. Then she had a debrief. they discuss different ways of dealing with that. She will change the way she deals with it in the future. That's what we should be doing.
Yes.
And we should be doing that all the time with everything.
And there is a slight position of hindsight with there, isn't there?
But always.
You know, I think the national decision model, you know, if you make a decision on the information available at that moment, then you're not going to go far wrong. But it's what happens afterwards with the organisation.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, as you say, we're making our decision based on the information we've got at the time. By the time that hits the press, or by the time it hits a hearing or it hits court, all of the other information is known and it can't be unknown. So people then judge you based on everything that they now know, not on what you actually knew at the time.
It's a good point you make. We could talk about this all day. I can hear police officers serving and retired listening to this podcast slowly going red in the face. So we'll move on. Let's look at leadership, shall we? So obviously you were a superintendent yourself. You had a leadership position. And I think in your blog, you highlighted a lack of leadership training, certainly below ACC level. So what sort of training do you believe is missing?
Everything for sergeants and inspectors. Again, it came from austerity, this. This training was one of the first things to be cut in austerity, training and HR. And yet it was the one thing we shouldn't have cut. So we see on LinkedIn, don't we, all the time, senior officers post, we've just been on this brilliant 12-week course. You know, we've been in America on a leadership course. We've been at the College of Policing for this brilliant 12-week executive leadership course. Well, that's really good. But when you listen to any police officer or when you read any survey about policing, they all say the most important person is the line manager. And we're at the position now where we've got 2-year officers as sergeants, 3-year officers as inspectors. Now, whatever you or I think about that, that's the position we're in. There are some benefits for that. There are obviously some negatives. But what we're never doing is giving those people any leadership training of any type. We barely give them training around what they need to do in terms of writing a crime off or looking at an investigation, let alone how to lead a team. And we don't give them any training on coaching, mentoring, leadership, welfare, well-being. We just simply, it's a vacuum. And we expect them to be plucked out as a PC one day. They might or might not have done the legal exam. And the next day, they're a sergeant on a team and they're in charge of 10, 12 people, hundreds of jobs, threat, harm, risk going crazy, and they're expected to lead those people. You will know as well as I do, Dave, some of the best police officers that I've ever worked with will not make brilliant leaders. And some people can be brilliant leaders and not have been brilliant police officers, but we really are creating this vacuum for these people to fall down. We're not looking after them. So we might criticise our sergeants and inspectors for how they're leading. We might criticise them for how they're not looking after people, not managing people's welfare and well-being, not challenging the organisation. But what we're not doing is giving them any training or skills to help them. There's just nothing. There is a complete vacuum. And Fiona Meachin, who you will know from LinkedIn, you know, I mean, I spent a few hours on the phone with her when she was doing her leadership thing for the College of Policing. And this is one of the things that I know everyone raises all of the time. We just do not do leadership training properly for sergeants and inspectors. And they are the first line leaders. They're the people who matter the most on that front line.
Why do you think that is? Is it just simply money, or is there not a will there?
I mean, I think some of it's money, because of course there's less ACCs than there are sergeants. So of course it's easier to train the ACCs than it is to train sergeants. So money is part of it. Will is another. Do we actually want to, or do we actually just want a sergeant in post so that we can blame that sergeant when anything goes wrong? Or so that we can say, oh, we've got 4 sergeants on this team and they're managing the threat, harm and risk and they're looking after their staff. What do the police force actually want? I don't think they care about the fact that those people haven't got leadership training. I think they think, well, I tell you what, you've asked for that position as a sergeant or as an inspector, so it's over to you to go and get your own training. But that doesn't happen anywhere else in the world. In any private industry, if you put somebody into that position, you look after them, you give them training, you give them skills, you might give them a mentor or a coach. In policing, it's just like you're here one day as a PC, here you go, you're on the same team, which makes it even harder, as a sergeant the next day, and you can just get on with it. Just make it up.
I've been out of policing now since 22, so I might be wrong, but certainly my own experience with some supervisors is that they will be parachuted into a department purely because
they needed experience in that particular field before they can then go on to the next promotion. And this is a criticism of the individual. I'm certainly not tarring everybody with the same brush, not at all. But there were certain individuals that weren't interested in the department they were working in. It was simply just to get a little bit of experience to get that next rank. They'd be role hopping every 6 months. How the hell can you get any experience of any sort when you're spending such small amount of time in a particular area of policing?
So it's whether they do get experience, isn't it? They get experience of, right, so I'm now in child sexual exploitation unit. Okay, I can learn a little bit about that. I'm now in a unit about fraud. I can learn a little bit about that. I don't know about you, but I've tried to learn fraud for 34 years. I still don't understand it.
Actively avoid fraud.
Actively avoid it, exactly. So, you know, yes, they move in and they learn a little bit of something, but the reality is they only need a little bit of something to pass at that next board. And so, A, are they really invested in the people in that department? Some are. Okay, so this is only some people we're talking about here. Some are very invested in the people that they work with. Some recognise that actually they're in that department and they can't interfere with the reality because they don't know enough about it. And actually what they do instead is really support the staff, really support them, really listen to them, really try and help them in that short period that they're there. So there are people who do that, but there are equally the people, like you say, who job hop so that they can answer the questions at the next promotion board and get through. And actually, they don't care about the wake of disaster that they leave behind them.
And another thing I've noticed in the police is, so let's say, I don't know, chief inspector, newly promoted, let's say firearms. So he's in charge of firearms for a few years, does a brilliant job. And then because he's done such a good job, right, we'll move you over into an area of policing you've never done before. But because you're a chief inspector and you've done a great job, the assumption is you will do a great job in this completely unrelated arena. And obviously the fail fall flat on the face. Why do we do that in the police?
Do you know, I have two different opinions for this. One is actually I think sometimes that's really good for people. And what I mean by that is that if you've got a really good leader, they should be able to lead in any department as long as they're humble enough to recognise that they don't know everything when they go into that department. And that's the difference. So you don't always need to know about a department in order to lead really well and lead that team really well and lead the people in it really well, as long as you're humble enough to keep learning and learn from the people in the team. And, I've always said this. This is not about, we have a hierarchical organisation, but for me, it should never be about hierarchy. I should never, in very rare occasions, never have to tell anyone to do anything as a superintendent, as an inspector, as a chief inspector. Actually, what I should be doing is all of us agreeing together what we need to do to get where we're going. And that's how I've always tried to work, certainly since I've become an inspector. I probably wasn't as good at it as a sergeant. I think I learned as I developed. And so I think that's really important that actually, just because we go in somewhere as a chief inspector does not mean that we need to know everything. It just means that we need to lead that team to provide the best possible service and give and produce what we need to produce. So the productivity has to be there, the professionalism has to be there, the leadership has to be there. So we can lead them to do that. It doesn't mean we have to know everything.
So bringing that to well-being then, Andrea, what cultural shifts are needed within police forces to better support mental health, do you think?
So culturally, I think this has to be a priority. So what I mean by that is when HMIC go into an organisation and they say you're really poor at victim contact, for example, victim contact then gets put onto the priorities, the five priorities that the police force have got. It gets put into the police and crime plan by the police and crime commissioner or the mayor. And therefore, what we're saying to the public is we know this is an area of concern. It's been identified in our HMIC report. As the public, you're clearly concerned about this. We're making it a priority. You can now hold us to account for that priority. And what happens in the background is loads of work, loads of effort, loads of resources go into ensuring that that area of policing is improved. So for me, we have to change the culture around well-being and welfare to make it a priority. Now, you'll hear a lot of sound bites from chief officers saying it's a priority. Is it? Is it really? So interestingly, Ian Cook and I had this conversation the other week around new chief constables going into police forces, giving out their priorities to the public. And are they giving out the priority of welfare and well-being to the public or even to the staff internally? Now, I think, in fairness, mostly they're probably giving that priority to their own staff, not telling the public, because the public frankly don't care. And that's where our first problem lies. The public do care about the welfare of nurses, but they don't care about the welfare of police officers. And that's the truth. So actually, as chief officers, they probably don't do that. But that doesn't stop them having welfare of officers or well-being of officers, development, support of officers as a priority. And as soon as we declare that to be a priority, something has to be done about it. Resources have to be put into it. Actually, what we're seeing instead right now is resources being pulled out of it. The Met have stopped all welfare support. There are people on LinkedIn, aren't there, who currently are in welfare roles who've now been taken out of those welfare roles. Again, because of money, finance. It's not austerity, but are we not close to it?
It's really odd, isn't it? Because I think one of the reasons, if it doesn't support crime or the reduction of crime, then it's not important. But yet, the police seem to be dealing with more non-crime incidents than ever. Although, certainly, that's the perception.
They absolutely do. I mean, policing's changed, hasn't it? And the crimes that we deal with has changed. But I just want to go back to that first point you made, actually. The welfare and well-being of our officers is critical to us being able to provide a service to the public. And that's what we miss. That is the direct link that we miss. I cannot do my job as a police officer. I say I. I've been out of policing 2 years and I still say I and we in relation to the police service. But I could never have delivered a really good service to the public, which is what I joined to do and what I still do today, unless I look after my team. Because a police officer who's shattered, filled with anxiety, really concerned over something that's happened, isn't sleeping because they're having flashbacks, isn't well enough to be in work because they've got flu, they're not providing a good service to the public at all. And so we have all of these things around, actually, you've not been absent this year, well done, brilliant. Yeah, but they were in for 2 days with a dying of flu.
Don't say they weren't ill.
They've shared it with everybody. Five other people have gone off sick. And actually, we couldn't even let them go out into the public arena because they were just so horrible that there's no way they would have wanted to go out and deal with the public. So the reality is that actually, if we're going to provide a really good service to the public, which includes reducing crime, managing antisocial behaviour, perception of crime, preventing crime, let's think about prevention for a minute, then we have to look after our police officers first. If we don't do that first basic thing, there's no way we can do the other bit.
We're even sanctioned on sickness.
Yeah, we are sanctioned on sickness.
Because, you know, if you're going for a promotion, if you want your pay rise, performance-related pay, I realise that's gone now, but, you know, bad sickness record.
Yeah, it does. It prevents you from moving on. It prevents you from moving into other jobs, going for promotion. It prevents you and everything. So a lot of people keep on coming into work and they keep on fighting until they're at the stage where they can't fight anymore and they break. But that's where line managers come in. That's where line managers should be saying to them, you are not coming in today, or you need to stay at home today, or actually, I can see that you're really struggling with that workload. I want you to do this and get this workload down. Write you off. Let me write you off. These are the inquiries you need to make. And then when you've done all of that and you're ready and you're clear, you can come back. Because that we need to be recognising that actually, if people aren't working at their full capacity, then they're not delivering a good service to the public.
Mm. I mean, we've been talking about the leaders, and I'm conscious I don't want to put the whole
no.
issue on the shoulders of leadership. And the reason I say that is because I'm not going to go into too much detail of it. The gentleman in question is long out of the police force, but long story short, he came into work drunk as a response officer. And that's all I'll say about that. It came to light. He was breathalyzed. It was over. He got charged and he got sacked. Rightly so. But people around him said, oh, we knew he had a problem. They didn't say anything. They just said something. Somebody could have got hold of this guy. Right, what support can we give you? You know, and he would probably still be in the job today.
So it's one of the things I talk about with my new recruits. We talk about all the time what we should do if somebody makes an inappropriate comment, for argument's sake. And of course, that comes from the new value of courage that has been created as a result of things like the Casey report and the Angelini inquiry, where we're really encouraging officers to report incidents that occur. Now, quite a lot when I'm talking to clients, they'll say to me, yeah, but if it's just something minor, we shouldn't report it. But these are what I always say. You have to report it. And the reasons why are this. One is it could just be a series of things that they're doing with everybody. And actually, it's a pattern of behaviour that the sergeant needs to understand, needs to know about, to do something about. Could be something so serious that, as you say, there's no reason not to report it. You have to. But the other element I always say is actually it can be a symptom of something that's going wrong in that person's life. It could be a welfare issue that's creating them to be sick or creating them to respond in that way. You know, for example, if an officer hasn't seen his kids for 6 weeks because there's something going on in court that's preventing him from seeing them, and then he goes to a domestic and he doesn't deal with the female very well because the male is saying, I've not seen my children for 6 weeks, clearly is going to respond in a very different way. So we do have to look at the welfare elements, because it does make a difference. So if we can, and I go back to prevention, we always talk about prevention is better than cure. And in policing, we never measure prevention. We measure crimes, we measure reduction in crimes.
How many crimes have you stopped this week?
Absolutely.
I don't know, boss.
I was told when I first joined, the very first thing I was told is, if you go out and you walk your beat, I did walk then, you walk your beat every single night and no crimes happen, you've done your job. But we don't do it that like that anymore. We don't work like that with people. But actually, that prevention of crime is surely better than crime occurring and us dealing with it and investigating it. It's the same with welfare and wellbeing. So the culture change has to be that actually welfare and wellbeing has to be looked after at the very beginning to prevent people becoming ill in the first place. Now, we know, of course, sometimes people will, but we can prevent a lot of stuff happening.
I wonder what stops people, though. Wayne Cousins, I can't remember the nicknames. He had a few that his colleagues had for him, but were fairly indicative of his behaviour, which, you know, we all know how shocking that was now. So if everybody knew, and why was nothing done? And I suspect nothing was done because the colleagues didn't come forward. Now, what is stopping people doing that?
So, that again, it comes back to, I guess, the culture that we're creating, doesn't it, around a learning organisation. So we've got that element of it's not learning. If I go and report this, will anyone listen to me? How many people will push me against the window before actually they'll allow me to tell the next person? So you've obviously got that. I think we've got a culture of actually we support each other no matter what. You know, it's a little bit like, you know, you can have two brothers that fight tooth and nail, but actually when it comes down to it, they'll always support each other and back each other. And I think there's an element of that in policing. And it's not something we're going to get rid of quickly, actually. It's something that we're going to have to evolve over a period of time, which is why they brought courage in. So I think it's an element of, actually, if I say something, I'm going to be ostracised from this group. I'm no longer going to be part of this group. And we've seen people being ostracised. We've seen people be completely eliminated from group activities because they've reported things. So actually, there's a fear anyway, because if I don't fit in to this group, where do I fit? And who's going to look after me at the other side? It goes back again to, actually, if I report something and it gets reported to PSB, do they look after me? Who's my welfare officer? And again, the people who are making those allegations or making those challenges are not being looked after either. So then you've got the person under investigation not being looked after and the person who's made the allegation not being looked after. And actually, even 2 years ago, just as I was finishing, I was dealing with a discrimination case actually in a different police force, which I won't mention. But one of the trainers had actually reported the other trainers for bullying and for sexual behaviour and inappropriate behaviour and actions. And as a result, they were ostracised. They moved departments. The news followed them. So they were then ostracised by the new department. They've ended up leaving the police force and going to a different police force where they've been welcomed with open arms, been really honest, but of course nobody knows each other. And so it's been okay. We get into that position because, and then everyone else sees that. So everyone else goes, well, if I report it, that's what's going to happen to me. But they're probably part of the group that have ostracised them because, again, they want to feel part of this team. So it's almost as though we have to have, again, it comes back to leadership for me, that because
it's breaking that chain. How do you break the chain?
So they're the ones that can break that chain. They're the ones that can go, hang on a minute, this person's made a really valid allegation and there's lots of stuff going on in the background and the investigation is going to take place. But in the meantime, as a team, we are still supporting that person. Actually, we need to support both while that investigation takes place.
And it goes back, I mean, on the flip side, a lot of false allegations are made, but it's what I said earlier, regardless of whether somebody is or isn't guilty of what they've been accused of, it's that support in that process of investigation.
Yeah, we've got to put that support in place, that peer support, that leadership, that time to actually look after someone. We need to make their care a priority.
So, as you mentioned, you're a trustee of Thin Blue Line UK. What role do charities play in filling the gaps left by formal support systems, do you think?
So I think there's three things. I think the first one is it's independence. I don't know a police officer out there who thinks that if they go to occupational health, everything that they tell them will be kept confidential. Now, as a superintendent, I absolutely believe it will. But I can understand why people don't believe that. And I think there is always going to be that fear that actually what I'm telling occupational health or what I'm reporting or what I'm doing is just not going to stay confidential. And it's not going to affect me moving forward into any other role in the future. Because we've seen it. You know, we have seen officers who have got anxiety or depression then be moved departments. Oh, you can't cope with this one. We need to move you to there. As opposed to what can we do to support you to get better so that you can continue doing this job that you're doing. So I think that independence is the first thing. I think that's why people go to charities. Secondly, the reason why people go to charities is because it can be very bespoke. So charities all choose different things. There's something called the Police Charities Organisation now, which is a group of all of the smaller police charities. They all do something slightly different. So, for example, cops don't deal with anybody who's lost somebody through suicide. They deal with people who've been murdered or died on duty. And I understand why they do that. I absolutely understand why. But then there's a vacuum. So who fills that gap? Then there's another charity that look at that, like Police Care or Thin Blue Line UK. So I think charities can be more bespoke in their offering, and therefore people can choose what they need at that moment in time, what they want to go to. So that's a really good beneficial point. So you've got that sort of impartiality, confidentiality, because it's outside the organisation and it's a bespoke thing that's really good and useful for you. It's like somebody going to Alcoholics Anonymous. The third thing is peer support. So if you go to those organisations like Alcoholics Anonymous, everyone else in the room has been an alcoholic or is an alcoholic and they understand you. It's the same for things like Trojan Wellbeing, because of course everybody that's gone to that has been subject to an investigation. And so that happens again with the charities, that you're actually going to an organisation or a group where there are peers who've been in that position, who understand it and who can really empathise with you. And I think they're the three things why reasons why people go to charities.
So do you believe Oscar Kilo's 24/7 helpline is a turning point in police wellbeing?
I absolutely hope so. So within the Thin Blue Line, we've been giving people access to something called Thrive for a period of time, which is an app. It's an online-based app. It's the only NHS-approved app in the country. And it's largely a CBT-type app, so you can work through a process, but it has 24-hour service from therapists. So if you tell them, you go on that app and you say, I'm really struggling, I'm at number 10 out of 1 to 10 on the anxiety scale or the depression scale, somebody will ring you. Somebody will ring you, they will speak to you, they'll have that conversation with you. And we know that that has saved lives. We know that from our information and our data, which is, of course, all anonymised. So if we can get Oscar Kilo trusted enough that actually people recognise that they can ring that 24-hour mental health line and get instant access to support and help from people who understand what they're going through, then that is absolutely a game changer turning point for me. And if anyone can do that, Andy Rhodes can, by the way, because I think Andy Rhodes is supported by the ACCs, the chief cons in the country, but he's equally understood to have a really good reputation amongst police officers. And that is in a really good position because of that. Oscar Kilo, as we've said before about HMIC, everything's recommendations, isn't it? So Oscar Kilo make recommendations. They don't have to fulfil them. But this 24-hour mental health line for me is critical. It's whether people believe that Oscar Kilo is separate to the police service or not. I absolutely and passionately believe it is. I believe it's independent. I believe it's completely confidential. And I really hope that police officers and police staff believe that as well and therefore make use of that service. Time will tell. It's only in the last 2 or 3 weeks, isn't it? But I absolutely think it's a game changer in terms of people seeking that instant help at that moment of real critical stage for them.
Okay, let's get real. Mm. You described the crisis as a critical incident. Superintendent Quinton, you are on-call gold command. And the wellbeing incident, I'll talk about wellbeing as a whole, then UK policing comes in. What are your golden hour tasks?
Golden hour tasks, that's the first one, isn't it? Okay, golden hour tasks, get the right people around the table. So, you know, for a murder, we would have people around the table such as forensics, wouldn't we? Forensics, detectives, interview teams. We would have external people coming in from different organisations, social services, anyone else that had been involved with that murder. So we would have all of that. So for this, for wellbeing, we need to get the right people around the table. That means we need people like the NHS, actually. We need the NHS. We need real good mental health therapists, mental health services. We need people who look at prevention. So we need the right people around the table first and foremost. Then we need to say, where are we at right now? And really understand where we're at right now, which we don't. As we've already said, suicide just is not even on the agenda, let alone people who might have tried it and it's not worked. That's just a lost. It's lost somewhere in the ether. So actually, you know, we need to know exactly where we are right now. So that would be my first thing. We actually need to say to every force in this country, you must, from this point forward, record any near miss, any incident that's occurring, and anything that is suicide. You need to record it, and it needs to be published to a, well, I would say the NPCC, to a national person somewhere that is managing this and collating it. Ideally, you would want a coroner involved in all of this as well. So you want that initial thing of actually what's happening right now, what position are we in? Then you want this element of actually what do we need to do right now? So there might be some immediate things we need to do because we've got people at crisis right this minute. So what are we doing for those people in crisis right now? And then we need to look at, obviously longer term, but prevention. What are we going to do about well-being and welfare that prevents people getting to that stage in the first place? Because if we can prevent everybody from getting to that stage, then we haven't got a crisis any longer. And that's where it will then become business as usual. It links into, let's make this a priority. This is our priority. We're naming it as a priority. We're going to have, we know where we are now. This is where we want to be in 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, whatever that is. Right, what's our plan to get there? And we need that action plan to get there, but we need to work with other partners to do that. We can't do it on our own.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. So how can the public play a role in supporting officers and driving change?
Well, that's a really interesting one, isn't it? We have to get back to recognising, again, I suppose this is partly the government, partly the police themselves. We have to be honest with the public about the position that we're in right now, because otherwise we're never going to get the public on side. So the NHS have naturally got the public on side. It's a cultural thing. It's a national thing, isn't it? We feel strongly about the National Health Service, don't we? We don't feel strongly about the National Police Service. Nobody does. So first of all, we need to be giving them the information where we're at. What have we actually lost? How many police officers have you actually got out there? This is the reason why some of that's happening. This is why you've got low detection rate, high crime rate, low prevention. So we need to be honest with the public first and foremost, because once we're honest with the public, I still believe the vast majority of the public really do want to support for the police. And I think they do care about the police. And I think they want us to succeed, because anybody who's travelled anywhere in the world knows that this is the best police service in the world. I still firmly believe it. I'm sure there'll be some people out there that argue, but I do believe we're the best police service in the world. I believe we're not inherently corrupt. We're not inherently bad. Yes, of course, there are rotten police officers like Wayne Cousins, absolutely, but they're a rarity. And so we need the public to get on side. We need them then to reject social media and mainstream media suggestions that actually that's not the case. And that includes not clicking on that clickbait, not clicking on that the headline, making sure that they read, as you say, underneath the headline, read those comments, and therefore specifically support the police officers behind them. So it's a two-way street, because we've got to do the right thing first. So every police officer for me has a duty and responsibility to look after the public, respect them, understand them, empathise with them, care for them, because that has that positive impact on that individual, which means they're going to say, police officers are really good. I'm not listening to what the media says anymore, because the people that I've met are really brilliant. And that way we can get the public support back.
So finally, two-part question. So if you could speak directly to an officer struggling today, what would you say to them? And then is there anything you'd like to say to a senior or senior leaders who might be listening to this podcast today?
Okay, so to an officer who's struggling today, firstly, they're not alone. And I know that they always feel alone at that moment in time. So please know that you're not alone. Please know that there are people, individuals and organisations out there that can help you. And that actually that criticality of feeling that you've got right now might not be there tomorrow. And so always just stop, reach out, talk to somebody. I know that's really difficult, because in those minutes when you're feeling really, really low, those 3 o'clock in the morning moments, actually, it's really difficult to stop and think, I need to reach out. Therefore, friends, colleagues, please always just reach out to someone if you know or you've got any suspect at all that they're feeling like that. Just ask twice. Always ask somebody twice. And that's really important. I did that once with a colleague. I remember I was walking past the door, 6 o'clock in the morning, going in. And I always said, hiya, you all right, mate? And he always used to go, yeah, fine, boss, you all right? Yeah, and that was fine. And we'd move on. And one day I said exactly the same thing. And he went, yeah. And I literally backtracked. I remember walking backwards down the corridor and just putting my head back around the door and going, but are you really all right? And he went, no, but no one's ever asked me. And, you know, that was obviously the opening. So ask twice for anyone that's there dealing with it.
And it's important to know as well that talking about suicide won't make somebody carry it out.
When we talk about training and we talk about leadership, we need to know that. We need to know that actually, and I've spoken to someone who actually subsequently did die by suicide, wasn't a police officer, but she was heavily involved in policing. And one of the things she said is that actually the point at which I always feel like I want to die is the point at which I'm really happy. And I'm really happy, but actually I never want to go back to that depression and that depths of despair again.
Yeah, because I've made darkness. The decision's been made and that's the way out. And that's
So I think that's really important for people to know. But do we tell people that? Do we share that with people? Where's the training around that? So yeah, we've got that element of it. So for the officers out there, you're not alone. There are lots of places out there that you can get help from, but I need people to reach into them. Just stop and think. And finally, just know that actually that moment will pass. So allow that moment to pass and then start thinking about your decision making again. Because I would hope that anybody who's died by suicide, if they could come back to this life, would go, actually, my life could be really good. It's just that I made that decision instead. We'll never know that, will we? So, you know, I can't. But yeah, absolutely. That sort of feeling is temporary. Reach out. There are organisations out there. We've already talked about the different types of charities and things that can be bespoke. So that's there. So the leaders in the organisation, this is for me a critical incident. You might not want to declare it a critical incident. That's fine. It's your choice. You're the ones in the organisation. But this has to be a priority. And until you make it a priority and make sure that the government, every chief constable, the MPCC, the Superintendents Association, the Federation, that all of those organisations that look after policing make this a priority, nothing will change. Because the reality is we'll always have a tick box of welfare and wellbeing. It's a tick box on the PDR, isn't it? But who actually does it? So until we have it as a priority, front and centre for everything, and recognise that looking after our staff is going to make sure that we look after the public, nothing will change. So this has to be a priority. It has to be a priority today. And they have to make sure that the action plan is national. The government have a 5-year suicide action plan. What do we have? Because we don't have anything in policing. We've got Oscar Kilo. We've got HMIC. Both are looking at welfare and wellbeing. But that needs to be mandated and it needs to be a priority in your police force now.
Well, it's a conversation I desperately wish we weren't having, but I'm glad that we have. Andrew Quinton, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
DCT Audio. The art of good listening.